This podcast is general in nature and hasn't taken your circumstances into account. It's important you consider your personal circumstances and speak to a financial advisor before deciding what's right for you. Any general tax information provided is provided as a guide only. Now, here's Shane and Deanna.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Simplifying Investing. Today, we have a special guest joining us while Shane Oliver's on holidays. Thanks for being here, Brad.
Thanks, Deanna.
Brad is one of our portfolio managers and also the lead PM for our separately managed accounts. We talk about economics usually on this podcast, economics and markets, but sometimes it's hard to correlate how that economics knowledge gets into the investing landscape. And Brad is the perfect person to talk us through that. I always look to you when we're talking about markets and what they're doing, and you always have a really nice way of summarizing what's been happening. So can you just take us through why markets have had such a strong start to the year despite all the negativity? If you put things into a list, I think the potential negatives outweigh the positives, and yet US markets are around a record high and also similar in Australia.
I always look to you. but the way I'd surmise where we are today is you take it back to October last year. And so October last year, all the talk was about higher for longer, and that even if inflation did fall back towards the target range of the Fed or the RBA, there was this kind of Volcker era shadow that loomed over central bankers that meant that, or the expectation was that even if inflation did fall, they would maintain a higher cash rate for longer as an insurance policy against that Volcker era. And so that was the sentiment at the time. Inflation was falling, but there was that reticence to confirm that they would shift from a hawkish to a balanced bias. They did that. They did that in October and November and December in particular last year. You started to get trickles of news from Fed speakers, and then Powell himself confirmed that the outlook looked more balanced and that they would kind of embrace the idea of cuts if they had to.
But then in the last week or two, we've seen Fed officials like Waller, one of the Fed governors, and Powell himself sort of start to talk back those expectations of rate cuts, and markets are getting a little bit worried that maybe we won't get those rate cuts come through.
Yeah, I see that as a much of a muchness. From where we were December last year, we were pricing we got to pricing seven cuts very quickly.
That was too much.
So from October, where you had a higher for longer and a tightening bias, if anything, or no cuts, you quickly went to seven by the end of December, and that was in the US. In Australia, it was more like three. We didn't raise rates as high as other countries, so we didn't have as far to come down, or we don't have as far. So it was at seven, and now we're at three or four again. And so what they're trying to get the markets comfortable with is the idea that if, let's say, unemployment stays at 3.9% in the US, which is remarkably low, maybe they don't need to cut three times, maybe only two, and maybe none. They actually need portfolio managers globally to entertain the idea that they don't have to cut, and that's okay. And the reason it's okay, just to make a really quick in aggregate kind of netting, is that if unemployment rises, so people lose their jobs and consumption falls in aggregate, then you can alleviate some of that lost consumption by cutting interest rates. And for the people that are still gainfully employed, their discretionary spending goes up. So there's my netting. In the scenario where unemployment stays where it is and you don't cut, it's kind of the same. So as long as growth remains robust as it is, there is no need to cut. And if you do cut, which is kind of where we got to in the plus 25% return in US equities in Q1, that scenario is just kind of Greenspan era positive. You've got positive growth, and you're kind of supercharging it with cuts. And if there's no recession, that's a really great outlook.
Okay, so what's the outlook from here then for most of the developed markets that we track every day?
So the outlook is a combination of outlooks, I guess, at any given time.
A probability or a range of outcomes.
It's a probability or a range of outcomes. So I'd never stick hard and fast to one. If we go through what the definitions are, the conventions at the moment, soft landing. A soft landing is where so inflation comes down but unemployment ticks up a little bit because those tighter financial conditions, they do have some effect on lower consumption and it requires rate cuts. And that restores kind of an equilibrium in the economy. That was the expectation throughout most of Q1. Then there's the hard landing scenario where the cuts come too late, that we've already baked in financial hardship, be it in the housing or the corporate sector, and something goes bust. That's kind of a tail risk, I'd say quite unlikely at the moment and always hard to foresee anyway. You can remove that scenario or take the probability of that scenario significantly versus the expectations in Q3 and Q4 last year. And I'll come back to the final scenario, which is no landing. But the reason why you can take down the probability of the hard landing scenario is all of these risks, recession, the cash rate has to be higher for longer, commercial property sector defaults or some kind of default somewhere in the economy, the catalyst for all that is inflation. Mm. And so inflation has come down. I think it's clear for all to see. And now we're talking about, is this as far as it goes or does it have a little bit more? And so you finesse some of the rate cut expectations about your views there. So the hard landing scenario is down in the 5 to 10% for me. And the no landing scenario is we don't have to do any cuts because growth keeps ticking along, defies the odds that we had tighter financial conditions and nothing really came of it, which still seems a bit odd to me ultimately. But there's that scenario where you don't have to do anything. I think that's actually quite a good scenario. After markets get over the fact that there's no rate cuts and they can't discount future earnings by as much as they'd like, and there's a little bit of volatility that has to go hand in hand with that and maybe a 5% correction, then you go, oh, central banks have a few cuts up their sleeve if they need them, but the economy is doing fine without them, and that combination is quite powerful too. So call it what you like, a modified soft landing or a hard landing. And those are the base scenarios at the moment and they're quite positive.
But we wouldn't want the situation of a hard landing or a recession because we know that the worst equity market downturns are in those periods. So how do investors know when we're inching towards a recession? I mean, it's so hard to predict, and a lot of the economic data actually lags all the way up to the point where you get a recession. A lot of people look at the unemployment rate, but actually it's one of the most lagging indicators of the economy. It can actually keep falling up until the point where you go into a recession. But if you know that markets can go down 20 or 30% during a recession, how can you hedge your risks for that?
Yeah, and the doomsday profits, they always come out after the fact. And that's just a testament to the fact that it's really, really hard to see in the moment in time, and I can't see right now where the kind of catastrophe comes from or where the recession comes from if there's a sudden onset.
And I guess we look at the indicators of recession, you know, when we chat every week about our positioning, and we kind of go through the checklist of things, and actually things are looking a little bit better from that front. Like some of the leading indicators have improved, the PMI and the ISMs, especially in the US, are starting to increase. So as it looks right now, the odds of a recession look lower than where they did 6 months ago.
Yeah, and you do have to sift through the information. Defaults are rising at the moment, and arrears are rising, but at the same time, the big four banks are reducing loan loss provisions. So it tells you that we were expecting defaults and hardship to increase, but at the same time, it's not happening to the extent that we thought it would or that the banks thought it would. Mm. And that in and of itself, in an aggregate sense, taking aside the individual circumstances, that is a positive for the economy. In addition, the banks are very well capitalized if there were to be ongoing provisioning required.
Okay, so we are in the business of investing and we do have to, you know, make a call on things because of that. How are we positioned in our AMP funds at the moment, given this environment that you've just talked me through?
Yeah, so our, I guess, house view, our house positioning at the moment is starting with equities, which is a thing that is kind of most critical to get right. So touch wood, we are, and we have been, is that we're overweight US and global equities. Mm-hmm. And we're overweight equities overall, but we have a slight underweight to Australian equities.
And why do you have that underweight to Australia?
So when we look at the picture internationally, earnings in the US are expected to grow about 12% over the next 12 months. Europe a little less, around 8%. Japan's around 12%. So the major economies are seeing some pretty good growth and a continuation of that in the subsequent 12 months as well. Australia's a bit more modest at 4%. Mm. And so Australia's a little bit different. Each economy's got its own drivers. Ours is that we're more sensitive to higher interest rates. And unlike in the US where they fix for 30 years, we fix for 2 or 3 years. And there's been this mortgage cliff that's been playing out over 2023 and 2024. And that's about 25% of all mortgages have switched from ultra low to something that's a multiple of what it was. Mm-hmm. And so that weighs on consumption in Australia. And then also our biggest trading partner is China, is decelerating and kind of not showing a great deal of motivation to right the ship in a dramatic way like they used to.
And for an Australian investor, once you take into the account of franking credits and the high dividend yield that Australian shares have been paying and still continue to pay, is there a difference then when you take those things into account?
There definitely is, and it depends where you are in your investment journey. So for an accumulator, for you and I, that definitely matters in terms of we are more susceptible to the China, the current predicament in China, and the lower growth there. If you were a retiree, like parents, then the franking credits matter more and you wouldn't underweight Australian equities.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be a wise move because your total returns still bolstered by those franking credits. Mm. And so your appetite for these active tilts would be less.
I think that's so important to keep in mind when you're investing. I mean, so it's, you know, easy to say our positioning is this, but you do have to keep in mind, obviously, that everyone is in a different life stage and at different points in time, growth and income might be more important. And what about our fixed income positions?
So our fixed income positions, we're neutral. So we have the falling inflation dynamic and the potential for that to continue. So that pulls government interest rates lower because of the potential for short-term interest rates to fall and hold at a lower level in line with their longer-term historical average. There's also in the back of your mind the risk that they revisit 5%. The last couple of inflation prints from the RBA for Australia and for the US have been sideways to surprising to the upside. And so you have to be cognizant of that risk, a second wave of inflation. I don't see that playing out, but that is a risk in the probability game that we have to play. There's the risk that growth in that no landing scenario, growth continues to surprise to the upside and in turn the cash rate will stay higher for longer. You also have to earn a premium over and above inflation, a real yield. Investors demand a real yield or have historically received one. And so about 150 basis points above inflation is kind of a normal level for a nominal government bond yields to sit at, roughly where they are today. So in a fair value sense, it's kind of neutral, taking all these other scenarios into account. The last risk that I'll mention to the upside is mostly under a Trump presidency is that if he cuts the corporate tax rate in the US, pulls it back to 21% and continues to expend while the US is running a large government deficit and high debt to GDP, then an additional premium called the term premium that investors will expect to receive as compensation for essentially their default risk, if you can believe that the US can default. But it does invite messier scenarios where it's more difficult for them to fund themselves and for that rolling spending bill drama to play out in US Congress. So that requires an additional premium, which has historically been around 1%, going back several decades, and currently it's 0%. There is no term premium assigned to longer term US debt. And that's something that I think investors should start to factor in for their interest rate outlook as well.
Yeah, I think we need to do a longer episode on the impacts of the November US presidential election and around the geopolitical risk that that could entail, because there could be some pretty big policy changes to the US if Trump gets reelected, particularly around the fiscal settings, taxation, and then, of course, tariffs on China and global imports as well. But that's it for today, everyone. Thank you so much, Brad. It was a pleasure to interview you.
Thanks, Deanna.
And until next time.
For more info on Shane and Deanna's podcasts and reports, head to the Insights Hub at amp.com.au.